Realized beings abound these days. Care to comment? When the conditions are conducive and the inquiry is in earnest, is it possible to wake up quickly? remember when Ajahn Chah came to America to teach, and he came one time, and he was actually he was teaching at IMS, and there was a session after he'd been there for a while, and people sort of talking. Teachers, he was sort of asked, you know, now that I can't remember how it actually went, something like, now that you've been here in America for some, because he'd done some traveling and gone to different places and taught in a few different places, and now that you've been in America for a while, you know, how do you feel about Buddhism coming to America? Ajahn Chah had this sort of blank look on his face. He said, Buddhism hasn't come to America yet. I haven't seen any Buddhism yet. Ajahn Chah can be naughty sometimes. certainly when the conditions are conducive and the inquiry is in earnest, it is possible to wake up quickly, but it's usually the finding conducive conditions and having that earnest inquiry is not that easy. It's theoretical. It's a good thing, but to really sustain it, to really be clear, to really be focused. Not that easy. Again, Ajahn Chah, where he said so much of his teaching was around patient endurance, because that was really what's required. If one sets one's intention to sort of wake up quickly, I think we all do when we first start practicing, and that was when, I ordained with the idea that, take a temporary ordination, learn a bit about meditation. I had 3 or 4 spare months, and it should stream entry at least. Then I could go do what I wanted. I wouldn't have to be reborn in the lower realms again. it's not quite that easy. But certainly attending to those conducive conditions and the earnestness of the inquiry, that's really important. Oh, which suttas describe path and fruit? I couldn't off the top of my head. And be able to certainly there's two different kind of modalities. One is sort of the path and fruit in terms of as I described it the other night. And there's also another kind of modality of sort of seven-factored description of sort of realization path and realization. That's in Majjhima 70, the Kithagiri Sutta. That's one of the places that it comes up in Majjhima Nikaya 70. Path and fruit is fairly ubiquitous. But to have a really good one off the top of my head, I don't have one. I could probably scrounge around and find one and let people know. Okay, I'm hoping to go to the Udon Thani and Konkan area of Thailand. Are there temples and teachers you know of there that you would recommend for lay practice? I'm also curious to know the name and location of the teacher you mentioned today who has students stay on themselves as metta objects for so long. That seems appropriate for, quote-unquote, my case. That monk's name. He lives on the outskirts of Bangkok. Yes, that's it. The Jen Maha Chat Chai. And it's actually what playing in Nontaburi. It's on the outskirts of Bangkok. Udon Thani has scads of forest monasteries with good teachers. Konkan is not so much. I mean, it's close. They're close by each other. There's not so many teachers that I know in the Konkan area, but Udon is very rich because Ajahn Mahabua is his monastery is in Udon, so that he has one. There's a very strong presence of the disciples of Ajahn Mun, who Ajahn Mahabua is one of them, and then of course Ajahn Mahabua has taught for so long that he has many disciples and affiliated monasteries. Because there's always a problem in Thailand of language. But the there's a group of Westerners at Ajahn Mahabua's monastery, and there's always a group there. So that's the best thing to do, is just go get local knowledge where there's some good practice places in that area. But yeah, there's lots of very good teachers up in that area. Okay, would you say a bit about the benefits of dwelling in loving kindness during the dying process, both for the caregiver and the person dying? Of course, the immediate benefit of that during the dying process for the one who is the person dying, then of course is the mind is not drawn to negative mental states, so that there's that eases the whole process of dying and the diminution of fear, kind of the physical ease, and then the clarity with which one is able to pass away and let the body go, because it's held within a sphere of loving kindness. So that's a tremendous benefit. And for the caregiver, that ability to retain the perspectives on loving kindness and to dwell on that is because it's very tiring looking after a dying body. I mean, so that there's endless amounts of frustration that can come, or the uncertainties that come, so it can be very tiring. looking after somebody who is dying, so that they that dwelling in loving kindness is a way to ameliorate some of either the frustrations or the worries and fears and projections that come, or the because sometimes when overextends oneself and is, you know, trying to be the ideal caregiver and to be able to be with loving kindness, or saying, you know, I'm really fried, I really need to ask somebody to help out. And that's an act of loving kindness, and it's really these bodies take an enormous amount of they're really high maintenance when they don't work. Ajahn Chah, in the last years of his life, it was like 9 years, he was unable to look after himself. Bedridden, unable to speak, unable to use his limbs, and it was the monks who sort of looked after as the primary caregivers. But it was a wonderful opportunity for the monks to look after him and give to him. But it really took. They set it up extraordinarily well, in that there was 4 monks and a novice in the daytime, 4 monks and a novice at nighttime, and really looking after all his needs. And there would be a very experienced monk as a sort of the head monk, looking after everything. Another monk who was somewhat experienced, and then there could be 2 sort of completely inexperienced monks. So that there was, and every 2 weeks there'd be a change, and people would come to Ajahn Chah's monastery and wait to get in line to be able to care for Ajahn Chah, and that was a. And they wouldn't do anything on Ajahn Chah that they hadn't become proficient at on themselves. So as it got to later stages of, say, nasal feeding tubes, and the monks had to train on themselves before they were allowed to sort of even get close to Ajahn Chah. So he was bedridden for 9 years and never had a bed sore, which is quite astounding for anybody who's had that experience. Just sort of the level of care, and it was really done out of, I would say, gratitude, respect, and loving kindness. Just so there was it was a real honor to be able to look after him. But that's, most people don't have a huge sangha of monks, and it's hard work looking after bodies that are breaking down. So one of the acts of loving kindness or use of loving kindness has been that realistic recognition. Well, how can I also be kind to myself, and then how can I also be drawing other people in to help as well? Because oftentimes we feel that it's sort of, we should be doing it, and it's sort of like the horse in Animal Farm. Can't remember his name, but it was like kind of, I will work harder, I will work harder, I will work. So, and of course, the pigs keep piling on the work, and it collapses and dies, and gets shipped off to the glue factory. But that sense of if I just work harder, then it'll all. And it really it's important to have that quality of loving kindness to sort of say, well, that's about my. This is about my limit, and I need to be able to find other resources or help others or find another way somehow to be able to deal with that. Okay. If everything about me, my body, thoughts, feelings, consciousness, is impermanent, and even my, quote, self, unquote, is illusory, the rising and falling of karma, then who or what am I addressing when I wish myself well-being? So, the thing is, it isn't as if nobody's home. but it's the, this conventional self that is a focal point and has taken rebirth and has a body and has a mind. And has, the results and ripening of karma from the past. These aren't illusory in the sense that they have no meaning, no effect. We experience the results of that. We feel that. And part of the means of disentangling oneself and ceasing to suffer from the complications that we make of that self is loving kindness. It's one of the skillful means for ameliorating. And negation of self is just as much a wrong view as the full blown belief in self. I mean, it's a very narrow balance or tight balance that one needs to make in order to understand the teachings, because it's not a nihilistic teaching. That's one of the fundamental wrong views that the Buddha points to as a source of suffering. It's both the sort of the being caught up in the self and what we perceive as self, but also the negation and the kind of tendency to annihilation of self is also a wrong view that leads to suffering. So that there's a there's a very real cause and effect process going on, actions, results of actions which we feel and experience, and the skillful application of that which is positive, wholesome, leading to peace, clarity, well-being. These are exceedingly useful. For most of the time on this retreat, I've had a lot of thoughts and worries about a problem I have been dealing with in daily life and which I will continue to have to deal with after the retreat. I've tried to work skillfully with it, extending metta to myself and others involved, doing mindfulness practice, working with anxiety, anger, aversion, playing out all the possible scenarios, returning to the body, but it only seems to intensify, feels obsessional. I recognize this pattern from numerous prior retreats, although the thematic content changes. Feeling discouraged. Any suggestions? I think one of the things is recognizing if one has experience seeing, oh, that's the way the mind tends to go and grabs a particular scenario, difficulty, and then it obsesses on it. There's anxiety, fear around it, and saying, okay, that's a reasonably well established pattern, and to be able to sort of recognize that and say, well, can I have loving kindness just for that tendency to follow that pattern, to be in that pattern, rather than trying to, I need to loving kindness for myself, need loving kindness for that person, and trying to sort of parcel it all out, but just to be able to bring a sense of kindness, well-wishing, just to that pattern, seeing that pattern of how the mind loops into that those reactions. And also one of the, 'cause that it gives some, it helps to give some space, it sort of giving that, seeing the particular habit pattern, and then stepping back from the identification with and recognizing, well, that's, it's a worthy object of well-wishing. Another approach is you know, sometimes when we relate to ourselves, relate to our habit patterns, relate to our temperament and personality, who we are, and who we think we are, we're oftentimes not extraordinarily kind. We tend to be the expectations are higher, the level of patience is usually lower, and to sort of look carefully and perceiving oneself if one were one's close friend, would one respond in the same way? Just bringing that up as a switching. So one has it with the same scenario, but placing a good friend in the spot where one perceives oneself. And with that same scenario, circumstances, what would be the response? What would be and you'd find the response would be almost invariably much kinder, much more patient, much more spacious, much more forgiving, much more generous. And that's a very helpful exercise in sort of imagination or visualization, just to replace oneself with somebody who one perceives as a good friend, and recognize, oh, I probably respond in a completely different way. Okay, some confusion. Was Ajahn Chah an anagami when he became angry with the young monk? I thought that root of anger is uprooted at that stage. Please explain. Absolutely not. With that kind of anger, there's anagami is absolutely eradicated, the anger and sensual desire. So that... he was still, that was the sort of sign. Okay, wow, I really missed my shot. I've still got some major defilements to work with, and that's what he put his energy into working with. Would you explain in English the Pali blessing you chant after the meal offering? I can't remember the whole translation, but I know it is very beautiful and complements the concept of metta. I can't remember it either. Truth be told. The But it's one of the reasons why we don't do it in English is because we haven't got a really good translation for it yet, and we've tried on various occasions, and it's either hokey or clunky, and that's it. So that it has, we haven't been able to get it into English. But essentially, the chant is a wish, a recognition of the goodness that has been done, by the offering and generosity that allows us to receive those offerings. And one of the images is as a sort of like with water, as it wells up and overflows, then the goodness spreads forth, and recognizing the goodness that is done by the power of that goodness. May you be free from difficulty, illness. Receive blessings of goodness, and that through the force of the goodness that's been done, may you experience good health, long life. Happiness and well-being, and then the last chant is also by the power of the Buddha, by the power of the Dhamma, by the power of the Sangha, may the Devas protect you, may the forces of goodness, celestial beings protect you, may you live happily, something like that. So it's a very beautiful chant, and it is unfortunate that we still haven't got it together yet in English. But they're called like Anamotana chants. There's a few different ones. That's the basic ones we use. But Anamotana literally means sort of like delighting in the goodness that has been done. So that's the gist of it, the thrust of it. Okay. Can you please talk about the difference between awareness and consciousness? Is awareness a conditioned state, the way consciousness is? How can we be aware if not through consciousness? Yeah, exactly. You can't really separate out, say, the khandhas, the five aggregates of being. You can by using language and concepts, but in reality they're tied together, rely on each other, depend on each other. But the difference between awareness and consciousness is that, say, consciousness is the basic function of being able to be aware through the sense doors, so that eye consciousness, ear consciousness, nose consciousness, tongue consciousness, body consciousness, mind consciousness, the ability to be conscious of the sensory contact. Awareness, and that's a basic function of if you live, exist, have a body and a mind, then you have a basic function of consciousness. Awareness is a function of sankhara, mental formation. And the distinguishing characteristic of sankhara, mental formations, is volition, intention, jetana. And so that we're directing the awareness. So the ability to direct awareness, bring awareness into being, lose the plot with awareness, is again through the function of application of volition and intention. And so one can become skilled in the use of awareness, one can be forgetful in the use of awareness, because it's a, that needs to be nurtured, looked after, developed, whereas consciousness is a basic function of just receiving the sensory contact. So that's the basic difference. And they're both conditioned, in that they're all and of course, say we direct awareness through to the consciousness as well, in the sense of by becoming increasingly aware of what we're conscious of, then we can make more clear decisions, clear discernment of what is actually happening to us. Okay. Would you be willing to share some of your personal journey, including some description of your life before you became a monk, why you chose to become a monk, with the intention of shedding light on how the holy life can help people grow and change? Thank you. I have a very short life history. I grew up in a podunk little town in northern Canada. Got out of there as soon as I could. I became interested in Buddhism in university, late 60s. But that was I grew up in the province of Manitoba. The town that I grew up in is like 600 miles north of the American border. And there wasn't much Buddhism happening up there. It still isn't. But then went to university in Winnipeg, which is, you know, it's a nice city, but it's small Midwestern Canada. And so I didn't come into contact with any kind of teachers, teachings. But I had an interest and sort of tracked down as many books as I could on Buddhism. And then after finishing university and working long enough to get some money, then I headed off traveling, as many people did in those days, and traveled through Europe and the Middle East, India, and then was just passing through Thailand. I had a vague idea that I would go to Japan to sort of study Buddhism, because in those days the majority of books that you could get on Buddhism were about Zen. But then I arrived in Thailand and there's all these monasteries around. There was this, it looked like it was a Buddhist culture. It was really fascinated. So I stayed on, and I went to a few different monasteries, practice here, practice there. My introduction to meditation was a solitary 1 month Mahasi Sayadaw retreat. That was how I started to learn to meditate. And I loved it. How do I do more of this? You know, it was a bit difficult, but it was sort of because you know, they tell you to just meditate 20 hours a day and sleep 4. And when I was given the instructions, it was like 4 hours. I mean, that can't be real. So I mean, I just sort of disregarded that. And well, it just didn't sink in. It wasn't a part of reality. But I was meditating really diligently as much as I could, and then having some very interesting states, and then there was a bit of a plateau. I don't know, after about 10 days or 2 weeks or something, and then after a couple of days, then the teacher asked, "How much are you sleeping?" I said, "Maybe 6-7 hours a night." You know, I thought that was pretty good, and because I could see my sleep dropping, it was like, he just chewed me out. So you've been, you know, it's like, you slacker. You know, you've been cheating, and you've, so you built up all this sort of sleep. Go back 2 hours a night. That's all you can have. Just get in and meditate. You know. And so, oh, okay. So I was able to, you know, so I had lots of, you know, very interesting experiences with that meditation. As I mentioned before, I went to another monastery and was staying there and take a temporary ordination. It was a city monastery on the outskirts of Bangkok. And that's where I started hearing about forest tradition, Ajahn Chah. And then that sounded really attractive to me. And then I went up to, after I'd been a monk for about, oh, I'd only been a monk for about a month. And I asked my teacher, could I go up and pay respects to Ajahn Chah and visit any? And he said, "Oh yeah, I've heard about him. He's a very good monk." So I went up there, and I went into what Ajahn Chah's monastery is. Early morning, and you see the monks coming back from alms round. It was sort of winter mist in the fields. It was very ethereal. Came in. As everything sort of quiet and composed, this forest, and got the opportunity to pay respects to Ajahn Chah. So I bowed, and he finished by bowing. And he looked at me and he said, "If you want to stay here, you have to stay at least 5 years." Well, I guess it's not for me. So I stayed for a while, and then I went off to another monastery that was very quiet, and putting a lot of effort into practice. And And it was again, meditation was going very good. I was very diligent in practice, and sort of the months were starting to go by, and I just kept thinking of Ajahn Chah all the time. And I said, oh, 5 years is 5 years. I'll go back and give myself to Ajahn Chah. So, that's 35 years ago. there. Now that in terms of how the holy life can help people grow and change, especially after being in the robes for such a long time, been in monasteries where people come and train or people come and go. One of the things that is really clear to me is that there's no such thing as sort of the ideal monastic or the ideal practitioner, and there's that I've seen so many different types of people come, and some people stay and some people go, and some people are absolutely inspired and seem so sort of composed and knowledgeable and clear, and then they disappear in the middle of the night and they're gone. Or other people come and sort of problem after problem, difficulty after difficulty, and they stick at it and they change. And that's one of the things that is consistent. If somebody stays with it, and it change takes place. And people really do grow and change. Okay. It's been so helpful to hear stories from your own experience. Could you talk about some of the more challenging moments in your practice and how you worked with them? There. I've shared a few things in particular around conflicts with others, or maybe one of the things that might be useful is just I'm thinking of dealing with doubt, that's something that we all experience, and there doubt in ourselves, doubt in the practice, and one of the things that I found that is really interesting is the actual, as one give it's the actual, it isn't sort of me resolving doubt, but it's allowing the practice or the Dhamma to work, so that the it's like just getting on the bus, and it'll take you where its destination is. So that the because we don't really need to figure everything out or have it all sort of absolutely clear. But really, there's a modicum or basic sort of foundation of trust in the teachings, in the practice, and just to give oneself to that and then see what the results are. And the sort of the vehicle of the Buddha Dhamma Sangha. I mean, it's a trustworthy vehicle to be able to recognize the parameters of that, those qualities of generosity, of virtue, of mindfulness, of training, of reflection on basic themes. What are the just those basic things, and just really plugging into that and sort of getting getting into the vehicle and allowing it to carry you, to take you. And that's certainly what for myself, after some time, there's this issue and that doubt and that worry and that concern and that uncertainty, and then after some time there's of sticking with the practice and being with it, and then there's a realization. It isn't sort of you've had an insight into this and this is dissolved. But at some point you say, "All right, I used to doubt about that. I used to be really worried about that. Oh, that's not there anymore. Well, that's interesting." So that in reflection one sees, it's unraveled because of the power of the practice itself, the power of the path. Now, and that's and the confidence sort of grows then continues to grow in the efficacy of the path and the training. What is the Pali word for letting go or relinquishment? Well, there's a few. Please spell that as well. There's a few different words that say like the that sometimes get tied into say the word letting go, so that like I brought up the phrase today, sambe dhamma nalang abhini vaisaya, sort of all dhammas are not to be clung to, so that not clinging, of course, is letting go. Abhini vaisaya, abhinivesaya, abhini vaisaya, would be or nalang, nalang. Nalang abhini vaisaya is a reference to that. Patinisaga, P-A-T-I-N-I-S-S-A-G-G-A, patinisaga, that directly means sort of relinquishment, letting go. Vosaga, V-O-S-S-A-G-G-A, is a relinquishment, particularly around the sense of self, letting go of the sense of self, the sense of I. So that that quality of relinquishment is a patinisaka, vosaka. Those are very important concepts of relinquishment and letting go. And there's actually a series of it comes up in many, many suttas where the Buddha is outlining a course of practice, and then he said, that practice is accompanied, each step of that practice is accompanied by sort of the reflection on, say, impermanence, or we wake our solitude, and then dispassion, cessation, and culminating in relinquishment. And so those are a series of talks, or say the Anapanasati, that the cultivation of Anapanasati, mindfulness of breathing, culminates in the reflections on impermanence, dispassion, cessation, relinquishment. And those are important terms for reflection. So is this relinquishment, letting go, is this the opposite of upadana? Yes, it would be. It'd be the opposite of that clinging. He said, if not, what is anupadana? I haven't seen anupadana. But I'm pretty weak when it comes to having any real knowledge of Pali language, and that it's more through association, and I haven't put any effort into learning Pali. I mean, you come across it in just technical terms here and there, and you know, after many years of practice, and there's some terms that are strike a chord and they stick in the memory. Okay, is attavad upadana clinging to sakkaya dittis? So there's four different types of upadana or clinging, and the last one is attavad upadana, which is clinging to the belief in self. And of course, sakkaya ditti is Kunudamo. Come to my aid. Sakkaya ditti is personal. No. I mean, it's the 10 types of fetters. Thank you. Fetters, and they're the 10 fetters that are the obstruction to liberation. The first three are what obstruct the entry into the stream, and one of them is sakkaya ditti, the belief in the identification with the sort of body-mind complex. So it's a attavad upadana is much broader, because it would still play itself out in the more refined types of clinging to self and conceit, self-conceit. It forms the basis of sakkaya ditti, but it also forms its broader. And the difference between attavad upadana and dit upadana, dit upadana is clinging to views, clinging to views, opinions. Attavad upadana is the clinging to the belief in self, or and it's interesting that the structure of the language is not clinging to self is clinging to the belief in self, because sort of the self is non-existent. But it's clinging to the belief in it, at the wada. Wada is sort of like the belief or the kind of teaching about it or the structure of it. I don't think I'm going to get through this pile of... It's 8:30. People okay with going on through the questions? Yeah? Okay. Okay, we'll go for it. Okay. Okay, this is... Okay, you've been so kind and generous with your teachings. Thank you. Do you think being introduced to Buddhism guided you to the contemplative life, or would you have become a monk in any tradition? Would you share a bit of your story? So I did give a bit of my story, but you know, certainly there is a draw to some kind of contemplative life, some kind of when I was young, I wasn't drawn, religion really didn't draw me. Although that's probably just a manifestation of stubbornness and contrariness. but there was a real draw to something resonated immediately with Buddhism. And something also drew me to meditation, training the mind, and there was something, a draw to that, really looking for ways to do that. I remember when I the very first time I went back to Canada. Oh no, it wasn't. It was before even when I was. I think I was still at university, and I was out east visiting an uncle and aunt of mine, and there was shortly before I was already interested in Buddhism. Shortly before I left, and we were talking, and something came up about religion and Buddhism and meditation. And my aunt said, I remember looking after you when you're a small child, and some, as they do with little kids, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I said, I want to be a priest. And it was something that I was very embarrassed because there was another friend of mine with me. We were traveling out east. And, oh dear! but it was sort of I could see that certainly was something that resonated through, even if it wasn't conscious, something definitely drawing me to some kind of spiritual tradition, some kind of spiritual training. Okay. Could you say a few more words on posture? For example, I noticed that my body was leaning towards the left. If I weighted my right hand with intention, this seems to stop. Is this a correct tactic? Okay. In my martial arts training, a goal is to relax and make the breathing easier. Is that true of Vipassana as well? Yeah, I haven't really addressed posture very much, hardly at all, this retreat. I just somehow skipped over it. But in terms of posture is a very helpful anchor for awareness and being able to attend to posture, paying attention to a balance of posture, paying attention to the kind of energy we bring into the posture is very, very helpful in terms of the practice. And and by recognizing where our body either slumps or leans or drifts, it's helpful for just balancing energy within the body-mind complex. But also, sometimes you start to get a little inkling or insight into, well, what's going on in my body-mind, and by correcting or balancing the posture. And one of the things that's important is that the sense of relaxing, because this relaxing into the posture and then allowing the breathing to flow quite easily. If you're sitting like this, it's all sort of slumped over. It's very difficult to breathe. The breath isn't. So then the mind tends to get dull. The body will tend to ache. And also with the posture, when there's a nice balanced posture, that's just quite naturally, that's the way the body can sit still for longer periods of time. You can't force the body into sitting still and sitting straight up because you just get tense. But if you continue to relax and then allow the breathing to soften and balance the posture, balance the energy, then you find that there's a lightness within the body, a lightness within the mind. One of the things I try to draw attention to is whenever you go into a shrine room where there's a Buddha image, you almost invariably see the Buddha image is a very nice posture. You never see, they don't make Buddha images. It's just the archetype of sort of balance and poise and sort of composure is just that very relaxed posture. And I remember one time, it was the very first time that Ajahn Sumedho came back from England. He'd gone to England, established a monastery. He'd been there for several years. Then he came back to visit and pay respects to Ajahn Chah. And one of the gifts he brought was a kind of a Buddha image that had been Uh, sculpted by an English person, a student in England, and the image was sort of very upright and Ajahn Chah sort of saw it and was sort of quiet for a while, and he looked from time to time, and then finally he sort of said, in the Thai language, the word for a Westerner is a furung. He said, that looks like a furung Buddha. Looks very tense. That's priceless. Okay. Could you please explain devas to us? I had an experience yesterday after the 2:30 p.m. Dhamma talk, guided metta meditation, in which I may have seen a group of beings above us, particularly above you. This is not the first experience I've had with perceiving otherworldly beings, but this was the first time new ones communicated to me. They seemed to indicate, when I was saying the phrases, that they particularly wanted to be free from anxiety. Today they led me to also radiating compassion, using the phrases from the second stanza of the Sublime Abidings chant we did this afternoon. Once I focused on this for a while, they seemed calmer, and then I no longer felt their presence. I don't think I'm crazy, but I'm very interested in what the Dhamma says about other worldly / non-material beings. Thank you. Unfortunately, I'm one of the sort of the last people to give any direct experience with. Other than that, because I don't see other realms, I don't know, see other beings. But in actual fact, there's when I used to live at Wat Nanachat, there were that was a cremation ground. So there's many spirits there, many ghosts, as well as many devas, celestial beings. And on more than one occasion, it'd be either lay people or there's a couple monks who are pretty good at that. They'll say, come up to me after and sort of say, well, such and such the deva in that place or that spirit in that place would like you to dedicate merit and offer blessings for them. They always had to use an intermediary because I was thick. I don't get it. But my own experience having lived in Thailand for a long time and just being in a place that has a world view that is totally different, just the various experiences that I had and that other people who I trusted had, then yeah, certainly it seems that these are just another part of reality. Now, that being said, it's also, you know, one of the first signs of psychosis. it can be a delicate balance. Once you start, meeting somebody who's communicating with beings in other realms, better call in the professionals. But so it does need to be balanced, but I've met many people who are very very stable, very sane, very clear, and there's realms of devas, and particularly say in a place like this, whether it's a natural environment, it's a place that's protected. There'd be many beings in the area that are here, just sort of tree devas, forest devas, earth devas, they would particularly be drawn to the when loving kindness is, it draws a crowd. it feels good. They're drawn, that's a sort of a natural phenomenon. I just sort of see it as a part of nature, the person who expert was one of the monks we had visiting us last year, Dumpa Plien. His sort of connection with other realms is sort of very tangible, which was very useful, because Casa Serena at Abhayagiri, the Upasika's residence and place for practice, because it was offered by somebody who passed away, then many, many, many of the Thai women who stay there are frightened that there's ghosts there. Lumpa Plien, please come over to Casa Serena and we'll sit in meditation give me the straight scoop. Are there any ghosts here? We went over, did a whole sort of blessing chant and whatnot, and he sat and he said, there's no ghosts here. They were reborn immediately in just the force of their goodness. And then with an ongoing practice, and there's nothing but good spirits here. I'd say that not having direct experience, and to be able to rely on Lumpa Plien, and what Lumpa Plien said. Okay, what's the difference between meditating on versus contemplating or thinking about something? Can you give us some examples how someone would be skillfully meditating on something versus unskillfully doing so? And then the last question, what does sankhara mean? Meditating is, I mean, it's a generic sort of term. And contemplating definitely has the that sense of reflection, investigation, thinking. Meditating can use the thought process, but it can also be, the thought process can be still. Some of the you know, one uses contemplation and reflection to help the meditation process, either in terms of bringing up a sense of urgency, bringing up positive states of mind, like the loving kindness practices, but in the end, the meditation, say ideally, turns into a stillness and a silence, a freedom from the thought process, which doesn't mean that one isn't able to discern anything, but there's that restless thinking, that compulsion to reflect has settled, has stilled, and the mind becomes very still and clear, and there's a stability there and a clarity there that allows one to see things in a different light, and seeing things in the light of relinquishment, seeing things in the light of the sense of passing away or ceasing. Recognizing that, well, there's a quality, these are coming to cessation, settling. So that, but it's not, say, one isn't thinking about it. It's a very direct experience because the mind is still. And so the examples of, and that would be an example of skillfully meditating. Unskillfully, of course, would be obsessing on the particular thought process or obsessing on a particular experience, even if the experience is one of peace and stillness. One can still obsess on it. The assumptions of selfhood, or the extrapolation of one's worth and value around one has a good meditation, so one is a good person. One has a restless meditation, therefore one's a bad meditator, a bad person. That's unskillful. So those recognize, oh, that's just an impermanent experience, rising and ceasing. So that, and then there's space around that then. Sankhara is probably has one of the longest explanations in the Pali English dictionary from the Polytech Society, So it's a complicated word and concept, but sankhara, and it's used in different contexts. So that sankhara, in a literal sense, is something that is built or compounded or created. So it can be used in the chant that we do. Sabbe sankhara anicca. All things of a compounded nature are impermanent. But then it's also used in the, say that, rupang anicca, vedana anicca, sanya anicca, sankhara anicca. That's used in the context of the khandhas, the aggregates of being. And that's a specific sankhara in terms of mental states, mental formations. Those are the compounded aspect of the mental activities, so that has a specific meaning to it. Okay. We're getting close. Two more to go. Okay. When I think of people with spontaneous, open, generous heart, they're full of metta, karuna, and mudita, but do not seem equanimous. Can upekkha come naturally as well as cultivated? I think it really is a result more of cultivation and the... Because it isn't immediately apparent, I think, in human experience, that equanimity has a value. One can see the value in loving kindness and compassion and sympathetic joy, freedom from jealousy. But there's a kind of it isn't immediately apparent that equanimity. Well, what good's equanimity? Because the others are more bound with becoming, bound with all the positive connotations that we have associated with a good human being, and I think that sense of upekkha, that equanimity, that equipoise or imbalance, one doesn't appreciate it until one starts to reflect and investigate and see how difficult it is to actually sustain that or to be present with something that is... Okay, wow, not moved by circumstance, not moved by internally of the moods or impressions within the mind. Doesn't mean that when we say not moved, it doesn't mean dull, shut down, closed off, but being completely in tune, being very clear, and then not being shaken by anything. It takes some time, one, to appreciate that, and then two, to recognize, this is going to take some cultivation, it's going to take some work. And of course, when one sees recognizes the benefits of not being sort of dragged into the either one's own internal reactivity or the external reactivity or expectation of the world around one. There's tremendous freedom in that quality of equanimity. And those are, and they, I think, as one cultivates the attends to those qualities of metta, karuna, mudita, then as the one becomes more attuned to the sort of sublime nature of these wholesome qualities, and then one also starts to recognize what's the nature of the mind, in the sense that or the nature of desire, where our desires are always outstripping our experience, and so that you get your new whatever the latest gadget is, and the new ones come out, and it's got more memory, it's faster. So, oh, I like one of those. the new car. So, how many cup holders do you say that one had? And that there's not that nature of desire. So, oh, wow, this is something. Well, we do the same thing in sort of spiritual practice, and it can torment us, but it's also it's sort of quite natural, and if it's channeled, we can be trying to put it into skillful use. So this one, cultivates loving kindness, compassion, and say, well, that's pretty good, but I'll bet there's something more. So it's there is. It's the equanimity is sort of the refinement there. One draws, allows oneself to be drawn towards. Okay, last question. What is the difference between piti and sukha? And these are qualities that usually associated in meditation, as one develops a continuity of awareness, the mind is becoming more and more settled, composed, unified. And part of the, say, the description of, excuse me, of, say, of the first jhana, the first stage of absorption. Vitakka vijara, the directed thought, evaluation, piti, sukha, and ekakata, which is unification of mind. Piti is usually translated as joy, and sukha is usually translated as happiness. Classic description of from the Visuddhimagga, it's a very good illustration of the difference between the two, is the say the image of a person walking through an area of wilderness, dry, no source of water, no shade, so that there's an experience of heat, discomfort, suffering. As one's continuing on one's journey, then one sees somebody coming, and they're, looks like they're freshly washed, they look refreshed, clothes are clean, and they say, well, just over there, and you can see on the horizon there, there's a, that's a, an area of forest where there's trees, there's water there. You'll be able to sort of bathe and drink and rest as much as you like. And that feeling that comes up with that sense, it's not far. There's a sense of joy that comes up. Okay, great. And one continues the journey in no long time. One gets, arrives at that sort of oasis, that forest area. It is cool, it is shaded, there is water there. You're able to bathe, refresh yourself, drink your fill, and the feeling that arises then is sukha, it's the happiness. So that the difference is in the, let's say, the joy is in the expectation, and the happiness is in the experience. So that the, similarly in practice, as we begin to have a continuity of awareness and attention, the mind starts to become more settled, then we start to have kind of, you know, physically there'll be kind of, you know, kind of rushes of joy, of energy through the body, of, you know, joyful energy coming through the body. So that feeling of those kind of joyful energy that we experience is bhiti, and that so that, that can be experienced in different ways. So like sometimes when you're sitting and meditating and practicing, and the mind is settling, and you know, and there's might be some tingling in the body or some rushing in the body, and then there's sort of, you know, the breathing is sort of can sort of almost like, this is really taking in a deep breath. The body is really, it's experiencing a sense of joy. But it's not so settled. Whereas the sukha, so one continues with the, that attentiveness, mindfulness, as the say the mind is not shaken or distracted by that joy, then that happiness becomes much more pervasive through the body. It becomes very relaxed, very settled. The mind becomes settled. The body becomes very settled. There's some feelings of pain or discomfort are completely gone, so that there's this feeling of well-being. So those are the differences between piti and sukha. Piti can be, you know, a bit exciting. Like sometimes, you know, you're meditating and you know, there's tears of joy coming and reflecting on some aspect of Dhamma. And it's hard to get really peaceful and settled. If you're, tears running down your face, you need to blow your nose. keep being mindful and then settling, and it settles into a more steady sukha, happiness, and very pervasive. So that's and also allowing the, not I say, trying to control and force things at that point is really allowing the mind to move into an object of attention. So then there's a unification of mind that comes, and that ekakata. So piti and sukha, you know, they're very helpful tools in practice. But they're also, how do you say, they're a natural result. And people experience them in different ways. And if you create an idea or an ideal or a concept of it, and you'll almost certainly sort of block it off. So that to just allowing the most important aspect of practice is mindfulness. That's really the sort of bedrock, bottom line. Keep coming back to that quality of mindful attention, awareness. God, it's 9:15. Why don't we pack it in? I'm glad people have questions. I mean, and they're, you know, people are reflecting on their experience, reflecting on their you know, what the practice is. And it's really, it's very heartening to see.